the local elected officials are very sensitive about drug prosecution, and they have in most instances allocated it to them.
Is that the way it's going to work with the cities too, Mr. Carlson?
That's correct, Representative Clark.
Okay, what I'm trying to get at is in terms of the governor's proposed amendments, wanting at the state level, wanting that money to come back and have some legislative oversight on it. I'm trying to draw some parallels and some consistency in what we're doing here.
Representative Clark, I realize Multnomah County, and I'm speaking primarily from Multnomah County, we don't deal that often with the state police on joint investigations. I mean, we do. In fact, we have the state police have been very helpful on some of our things. But I'm saying, you know, if you look at 1,000 cases, the number of cases we're involved with a joint agency like the state police is not very often. This is the guts of what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Other questions?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I may say that I think that Mr. Bradley and I and Mr. Snyder are going to want to look at the governor's amendment now in light of the agreements that we've reached as between the cities and counties and see where that leaves us. The structure of the act is that Section 9 provides for distribution at the court level. That is, whether there are any private parties that have liens, banks, that kind of thing. Section 10 deals with what happens to proceeds that go to a local government, and Section 11 then is an alternative to that if the proceeds go to the state government. And what we may be missing is any kind of a link up in there. Though there is in Section 10 permission, if you look, I think it's in sub E on page 11 up on line 5, says the forfeiting agency may sell, lease, lend, or transfer the property or proceeds to any federal, state, or local law enforcement agency. So that as the local government, there's authority in there to dispose of those proceeds to a state or federal agency. And I think what we would want to see is some reciprocal language authorizing the state to do the same thing with respect to local agencies.
No, Madam Chair,
I'm
getting at is if in Section 10 or 11, whichever one it is, we're saying when money goes back to a county or city, in effect it gets routed through the general fund or that governing body to make the ultimate decision on what happens with it. I'm trying to find a consistency between that and what we do vis-a-vis the state.
Right.
And I don't particularly care which way it goes, at least at this point I don't, but I can't think of any reason not to do it consistently. Maybe there are some reasons, but I'll leave it at that.
Yes, Representative Vaughn.
Just kind of a parting shot. I'm concerned that the governor's amendment might be interpreted to supersede anything where you have the state police or some entity involved and say those agreements are all void, we get it all, you get reimbursed. I'd like that issue be addressed between the governor's office.
Yes, if we could, Representative Baum, so many questions are coming up. Corey, why don't you come up and help us out here?
May I say, if the committee wants to move the bill today, we can go out in the hallway and try and work out some language. If you're not going to move the bill today, we'll talk about it before the next time the bill comes up.
Well, let me be really clear on that, and I appreciate your question. We are going to have questions like this on more than just this issue. This committee feels very strongly in support of, at least the chair feels very strongly in support of the efforts that have been made in the forfeiture bill. We are not going to let a half-baked bill come forth out of the committee. And I think time is really helping us, time with the understanding that we have some severe limits on the amount of time we can spend. So time with the motivation to come together is to our benefit, and I do not plan to have a work session and move this out today, but I do want you to get together on these differences in the near future and bring us your amendments. Ms. Streisinger.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, a number of very good comments have been made about the way intergovernmental agreements work. It has never been our intent to in any way subvert those intergovernmental agreements or to in any way take counties or local governments' share when there is a joint agreement underway. Some clarifying language clearly is needed. I would propose, and we will come back with language, we want the Attorney General's office to have a chance to review it, and obviously the cities and counties as well, but a general approach to the issue, assuming that something similar to Section 12A being proposed by Mr. Carlson and Mr. Bradley is adopted, would be to insert in the middle of page 2 on our proposed amendments, after the provision dealing with transfers of property to transfers of equipment and so on, a new subsection reading something like, if an intergovernmental agreement is in place pursuant to section 12A of this act, an equitable portion of the proceeds may be distributed pursuant to such an agreement to a political subdivision participating in the seizure. And then the following subsection would be the balance of the property would pour into the fund, which I've described before. So that would, I believe, make clear that an intergovernmental agreement could come into play previously, and simply the state's share, the remainder of the state's share after costs and after intergovernmental agreements had gone into effect would come into the fund.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Ms. Streicher, we heard, I just heard from Mr. Bradley and Mr. Carlson that cities and counties are extremely sort of deferential and sensitive as this money comes back into their general fund and they reallocate back out to law enforcement. I guess I'm wondering whether we can be sure that at the state level that same kind of sensitivity and deference to the use of that money can happen if we bring the funds back into the state general fund and send them down to Ways and Means, or are they just lost forever?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, to address that that concern, we have put language in our amendments setting up a dedicated fund and specifying the purposes to which that fund can be used. Now, obviously, it is always possible in the budget process to say, well, we will simply use those funds to replace existing general fund dollars, and in effect, we will have taken away the, and if this committee wants to explore ways of further tying up the uses of those funds to, for example, dedicate them to specific programs or to enhancements above existing funding levels, we would certainly be willing to discuss those types of proposals. It would be our hope that this source of funds would be usable to, in fact, enhance programs in the areas that we've indicated, prosecution, law enforcement, drug treatment, and so on, rather than simply replacing existing funds.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
Thank you very much.
Right. Madam Chairman, if I may, I do have one other sheet. There's a copy of the front page of the bill that's got the League of Oregon Cities stamp on it. The first few lines of amendments on that are essentially housekeeping amendments. There are no municipalities as described entities in Oregon. They're either cities or counties. The reason I took out other political subdivisions, I don't think you really want to give school districts and port districts and agencies like that the authority to have forfeiture ordinances. So I have I proposed language that limits.
We have a water district in my
right.
That's in trouble.
There go the gym clothes.
Yeah. That limits the references in subsections 2, 3, and 4 of section 1, 2, cities and counties. You will see some language there in section 4 that deals with the right of cities and counties to enact forfeiture ordinances about other kinds of conduct. There's a great deal of concern, for example, the city of Portland has passed an ordinance in which automobiles of people who drive while suspended would be forfeited. The Oregon Bankers Association has proposed an amendment that's in your packet that has some technical problems, and when you called me up here, I was outside talking to the attorney for that association trying to work out that language, and I think it's best to say simply that he and I will continue to work out language and we'll bring that back to you.
I appreciate that. I think just for the sake of the committee, council had a comment on your comment about other political subdivisions that goes back to the thinking of the work group during the interim. Council, if you could share that.
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Carlson, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, the reason that the broad language was put in there was really more of a limitation in case there was something we forgot about, and if there was some other kind of governmental entity, local governmental entity out there that did have forfeitures, they would be bound by the procedures set forth in here, particularly as it relates to property interests, and would give proper notice. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
However you want to handle it. Thank you.
If there are other questions, there was. The committee is going to take a recess until 3:05. If there are other proponents of amendments, and I know that there are, I would appreciate you signing up so that I can take you in order. So we'll be reconvening at 5:03. The committee's in recess. Come back to order, and committee members take their places. We have a new sign-up sheet.
Good afternoon. Could you identify yourself for the
Madam record? Chair, my name is Steve Rodman. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Credit Union League. Mr. Augustine is temporarily unavailable and asked me to address our proposed amendment to the House Bill 2282. If I could direct the committee to page 7, line 11, that's where the main thrust of the amendment is. The way it currently reads, the service of the notice of seizure shall only, or only has to be made under reasonable efforts. Line 11 reads that the person shall make reasonable efforts to serve the notice of seizure. The purpose of the amendment is to remove that language of make reasonable notice and make it an absolute requirement that the notice of seizure be served upon all persons having an interest. All persons having an interest is separately defined under the bill as being any person who has filed notice of an interest or from whom the property was seized, or any person who has an interest in the property whose identity and address is known or ascertainable upon diligent inquiry. The purpose of the amendment is to clarify that all persons of record shall be notified. As the bill currently reads, the only requirement is that the person make reasonable efforts to serve the notice of seizure. And that leaves an open question as to what reasonable efforts are, and can also lead to some questions as to what's going to constitute adequate notice. If we make it mandatory, as any other service would be, we could clarify that you do have to serve the notice of seizure on persons whose interest is of record, just like any other forfeiture action.
Appreciate that. What is the contra argument, if I could ask you to sort of take the point counterpoint?
The counterpoint most likely is that you don't want the forfeiture being held up while you try to locate people, or you don't want to have the responsibility for tracking people down. So you make reasonable efforts to serve notice instead of just serving notice. If I may counter the counterpoint, the third part of the definition of all persons having an interest is any person who is known or ascertainable upon diligent inquiry. So that's where I think you get your flexibility. You under the amendment, you would have to notify persons who are of record and the person from whom you took the property. And then anyone who's left over, you make reasonable inquiry or diligent inquiry, and those persons would be served as well.
Representative Minnis.
A question, sir. I don't have any problem with serving notice on all the parties that you know have interest. However, in the event that a party lives in Jamaica or you know that they live there.
Uh-huh.
The question is, to what degree and how far do you go to actually serve notice? And if you've got a situation where the distance makes it precludes, you know, the availability of that person, it would seem to me we'd want to give it at least some out or some other direction, some language that would say that you can serve notice if a person's reasonably available and known.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, send them certified mail.
Representative Clark.
I think that, I don't have any problems using the phrase shall either, because ORCP 7D, last time I checked, it in very great detail goes through this whole scenario for us, what you have to do to establish. establish personal service, and it provides, if you can't find the person, what you do then. And I mean, it's this has already been done for us. And so I think, I guess I'd ask the question, the Credit Union League understands that by putting the phrase shall in there, we're not necessarily guaranteeing that the people who have an interest are going to in fact be served.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, that's true. If you are of record, you will be served, because you could look on the title, vehicle title, for example, and get the name and send them a letter. And if you aren't, then there are mechanisms set up under ORCP for service of any civil process.
Right.
They give you an out by publication or by general service.
So I just want to establish for the record that what we're saying here is that you shall follow our ORCP 7D, not that you shall magically make sure that you get this person served.
That's our intent.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions, Representative?
Just perhaps Mr. Shepherd or somebody, with reference to the civil rules, are those a problem for you? Or now obviously you thought about it, I would think, in drafting this.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, we did discuss this problem to some great extent in the working group. I have some concerns about the proposed amendment, and they relate particularly to the problem that arises in the context of these cases as opposed to the ordinary commercial transaction or property transaction with which this committee may be familiar in the notice context. And that is that what we deal with in these forfeiture cases are hidden ownerships that are intentionally structured to conceal the asset from the authorities. And the essential quality of many of these schemes is false ownership. Registration of the property, be it a car or real property, in the name of a person who does not exist, or of a person who in fact has no interest in the property or who otherwise cannot be located by design of the offender. And so to impose on the government an absolute obligation to notify even those people who are nominally of record could in fact result in judgments of forfeiture which are subject to collateral attack. If the proposed amendment becomes law, then judgments which were based upon a forfeiture in which a straw person or a fictional person was the named party, and the government obviously could not find a fictional person in order to satisfy the mandatory language proposed by the amendment, then we would not be able to proceed with the forfeiture.
Madam Chair, can
you? Yes, Representative Minnis.
A compromise, I'm wondering, since you represent the credit unions, you obviously have a lien filed of some sort. Could we draft some language that would deal with financial institutions that have a lien on a piece of property?
I think, Representative Minnis, let me see if I might be able to shortcut us here. The working group had ample representation from financial institutions, and I understand that the Oregon Credit Union League was invited, and I don't know how much you participated, or if Mr. Augustine participated. Council informs me that there is, and we see in the bill and in the proposed amendments, that there is substantial participation from financial interests. So my suggestion would be, again, as I suggested with Ms. Dreisinger and Mr. Frohnmeyer and the cities and counties, those folks, that you work these out in terms of an agreed-upon proposal and establish for the committee a unified front, as it were.
I just want to read this language into the record, because I think it's especially appropriate for a forfeiture action. 7D1 says, summons shall be served either within or without the state in any manner reasonably calculated under all the circumstances to apprise the defendant of the existence and pendency of an action. It goes on and on and on. And perhaps some language, and that's 7D1, perhaps some language in our bill making specific reference to that sentence in 7D1, so that it's clear, and we've already got a reference that we don't have to publish, at least under certain circumstances. I'm just nervous about starting to I'm nervous about the integrity of the service process generally, and I think that it's written broadly enough that we ought to be able to do what you're talking about doing. If we need some language to make that happen, that's fine with me.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
You interrupted me.
I'm not quite sure what
the purpose was for interrupting me.
I'm sorry. I was afraid you were opening the door really
to
an answer.
I wasn't opening the door. I was trying to find a solution. I guess with reference to Representative Clark's concern about the rules of civil procedure applying, I don't see any problem with that when you're dealing with a lien holder, someone who has some kind of an interest in the property, a mortgage or an auto loan or those kind of things. But I am very much concerned with what Mr. Shepard's raised about hidden ownerships, because I have personally seen that kind of a problem, and I don't know how it would really help us to apply that 7D sub 1 section. I think it may create some problems, maybe in the working groups and whatever they can deal with it. But I'd rather see that civil rule procedure applied just to those situations where you have a lien on the property.
Well,
if I may respond, Madam Chair. That to me is what's covered by subsection 1C of section 2 in the definitions, where you talk about any person who has an interest, including whose identity and address is known or is ascertainable upon diligent inquiry. You've got the people's record, that's sub A. You've got the people you took it from, sub B. Anybody else you think should have an interest would be covered under sub C. And if you have hidden ownership, then sub C should cover that.
Right. So what's your problem, I guess?
My problem is that as the language is drafted now, you're only making reasonable efforts to give notice to people of record. Why can't you just give notice to people of record and guarantee it in there?
Okay, Madam Chair, if I can pursue that, you're not concerned about the lending institution. You're concerned about somebody else, because you're going to get notice.
Well, Representative Minnis, Madam Chair, you would think we would get notice, but that's not what the statute says. You make reasonable efforts to give us notice, not give us notice.
Madam Chair?
I just want to kind of give notice that we have this amendment in front of us. We're not going to be in work session today. Let's explore this with the witness and move on.
You're talking about a bootstrap problem. You're saying that make reasonable efforts is in the bill, and then the civil procedure rules we're talking about describe reasonable efforts, and you're wondering whether or not we have to meet the actual civil procedure rules. Isn't that what you're telling us?
Representative Mannix, that's right. You're making reasonable efforts to make reasonable efforts.
Right.
Okay, and you just want to take the bootstrap out.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Genoa Hefke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Genoa Hefke with the Oregon Association of Realtors. As you will recall, during my February 20th testimony, our main concern was with the absentee property owner who may possibly rent to an individual who commits or who engages in the commission of certain crimes. It was clear with conversations of several members of the committee that they shared this concern, which we believe is addressed with the insertion of our amendment on page 4, line 13, after the word all. It would read, all interest held by the individual involved in the prohibited conduct in any real property, et cetera. So that would make it clear that only the interest in the property that was held by the perpetrator of the crime would be at stake. In addition, we have proposed a second amendment, which would delete all of section 15. We feel that this is necessary, and with the advice of our attorney, what he calls the slander of title, which is an intentional tort. We are concerned that the title of the property may be clouded forever without any mechanism of getting that title clear, and that is before the commission of a crime has even been proven. And with those two changes, Madam Chair, I believe that we could support this bill.
Questions? Representative Clark.
You want section 15 out altogether?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, we do.
Madam Chair, do we have copies of those amendments?
Yes.
Somewhere.
Where are those?
It's just they're attached to our package of amendments, Representative Minnesota.
I think it's item 11.
The last
item 11.
Page?
Excuse
item 11.
The very last page. I can share a spare. I've got a few spares.
We have.
All the way back.
In case you brought your old amendments that council had provided, we have a new package.
Madam Chair, I do have additional copies if that would assist the committee.
So do I.
Representative Mannix is always prepared.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Clark.
I guess I have a question on, as I read Section 15, it says that basically it gives the seizing agency or forfeiting agency sort of encourages them to go out and put notices in the real property records that this property may be contaminated.
That is correct.
Does that happen now?
Clark. Not that I'm aware of, Representative Clark, Madam Chairman.
May I inquire on that?
Yes, I should.
I'd like you to take a look at Section 15, and I'd like to suggest where I'd like to stop and see what your reaction is. I think there should be a protection of liability here, but take out this notice, which you talked about as being a slander on the property. What if Section 15 just said, and this, as it is now on page 11 at the bottom, no seizing agency or forfeiting agency shall be liable for any claim asserted by any subsequent possessor of forfeited real property on account of the alleged contamination of the property, period. Then take out the rest of the slander on the property business. That's just another governmental immunity provision.
Council, I wonder if council could address this from the point of view of the working group. Do you recall the discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do remember the discussion, and if I do remember correctly, I think the proponents of this measure were people who were local governments that were going to be involved in forfeiture activities and were concerned about getting the meth lab property. Some of them may be here, and I'm sure they'd be quite willing to address the issue just from their viewpoint.
Madam Chair, we understand if there is a genuine problem with a meth lab, why that has to be on the title, that it may be contaminated to protect future occupants. The way this reads, and at the, I don't want to inflame Representative Minnis, but if a law enforcement agency were to become angry with a landlord because of habitual, what have you, renting to individuals who continue to commit crimes and said, fine, we're going to take care of you, we will cloud your title forever, and there's no way you can get that off. I know that that's not the intent, but as long as it's possible and subject to interpretation, we feel that it should be addressed.
Council has something to add to the discussion here.
I think part of the argument may be if there's a duty to give notice, no better place to give notice can be given than in the record.
Well, Madam Chair?
Representative Mannix.
My own reaction is let's pull, you know, when you've got a hazardous situation, pull in DEQ, clean it up, but don't make the property title as dirty as the property may have been.
Madam Chair.
Representative Minnis.
We might want to have the Representative Cease's committee come in here, because if you start delving into the whole issue of DEQ and contaminated meth sites and how much the state appropriates for cleanup and so on and so forth, you're running afoul of the whole nine yards. But you get into that issue, the state has not taken its responsible role in terms of cleanup in the first place, and having had some problems in my own district relevant to meth labs and cleanup, the city of Portland refuses in certain circumstances to take responsibility for cleanup. The state won't take responsibility for cleanup. There exists no research data either on the part of the state of Oregon or on a national level to tell us how we can clean these pieces of property up. So I think it's very important that when you do have a piece of property that is subject to contamination, that people who may subsequently have title of the piece of property have notice that, in fact, they're buying a piece of property that may be subject to being buried someday.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, we agree, and the Oregon Association of Realtors has introduced or has requested that other legislation be introduced to address the cleanup of meth labs. All we're saying is it would be nice if they could show that that crime had been committed before they cloud an innocent person's title forever.
Madam Chair.
Other comments, questions, Representative Mann?
Are you making that distinction? Because this is a civil proceeding with a reverse backflip on the burden of proof. That is, we get to go in and forfeit, we don't have to prove anything, la-di-da, whereas the statute, the other bills you're talking about, the government has some burden of proof?
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Madam
much.
Madam Chair, I want to ask another question, being in real estate. I'm personally involved in helping clean up a lab at a motel on 82nd Avenue in Portland that, you know, our people came out and put on their rubber outfits and went in and with independent air. They collect all this stuff. They bring out the chemical companies to get rid of all these chemicals. The very next day, that business is open and back in operation and re-renting that same room again. Now, I guess my question, the reason for arguing why this should be there, is that in the event that that owner of that property turns around and sells that property, I mean, you're selling something that may carry a whole lot of civil liability along with it for the future injury to other people that might occupy a room or a rental or something of that nature. So I don't know if you have any response to that, but I mean, it would be easy for you as a realtor to say, okay, fine, this property is free and clear. There's nothing here flagging it as a potential problem, but in fact, there is a problem.
I have a question on that. I'm sorry.
Representative Mannix.
How could someone else be...